Hello and welcome to Prime Lenses. I'm Ian. Each week I speak to a photographer about three lenses that have meant something to them on their photographic journey. It's unashamedly gear chat, but hopefully focused more on the images made with that gear than performance metrics and graphs. My guest today is John Casco. He's shot professionally for over 40 years, and in that time he's gone from dropping expensive cameras at weddings as an AP, don't worry, it worked, and you'll hear about it later, to photographing some of the defining artists of our time, from Elton John to Madonna, Steve Martin. Like, just look at his website, it's incredible. He's a no-nonsense pro with a preference for a simple setup, and that's why I really wanted to talk to him, because he's seen and done it all. And so it was great to talk to him, but also great to hear that after all that time, he's still looking to change and evolve his photography over time. It's no longer about perfection for him. He doesn't want to seek the cleanest, crispest image. He doesn't put pressure on himself to always use the best camera. His YouTube channel has me itching to get a flash and some lights, and I'm sure you'll get the bug too once you spend any time with him. So here's my conversation with John.
I apologize for the no video, but I'm trying to prepare for a quick trip.
Oh, no, that's all right. That's absolutely fine. Thank you so much for fitting me in. Luckily, it's an audio thing. I just like to kind of like make myself visible as an option, I suppose, because people have often
met me. Yeah? Sounds good. At least you're handsome.
Oh, thank you. We got it on the recording. That's it. It's job done. The show's over. Thank you so much. To be told by someone who photographs models, to be told you're handsome. That's made Thursday night. It's warmed me up. Thank you so much.
I really, really want my check in that mail soon. Okay.
Yeah, no. I'll write it. I'm writing it right now. It's here. Look, I've got it next to me. Are you in New York at the moment, or are you traveling and bouncing around for work?
I'm in Pennsylvania now, and I'll be in New York soon.
Cool. So you find that you're traveling quite a lot, because you know,
for two reasons. I have a daughter that's an actual influencer. She's pretty big in the beauty influencer space, and so she has a place now in Jersey City that I go visit her at. But it makes it easy for me and cheaper because I can stay with her now. Yeah. Versus getting hotel rooms, so it's kind of nice to have someone like that.
Yeah, I travel a lot for work as well, and knowing people when you get there is just so much nicer. Than you know, even if it's just people to hang out with before you go back to a hotel room, it can be life on the road.
I don't ever want to hang out with her. I like the free space.
There you go. They see, they're giving me ideas. I've got two boys, they're 6 and 9, so they're not old enough yet to give me a space to crash, but that's on the list now. Like, I've put them up for long enough by then.
Well, I told my daughter, I said, if I ever had another kid, I push them right into social media influencing, because it's just ridiculous. It's a very good living, so I'm happy for it.
Yeah, The Verge actually just put out a video today about a guy who started in 2019 with posting stuff about unnecessary inventions, is what he does. Wow. So he did a Tic Tac holder that is like a holster so that you can stop the Tic Tacs rattling around your pocket, like things like that. And now he started in 2019 with just stills and just images. And now in 2024, he's got a studio set up in what used to be a Gap, and like just a wall of 3D printers. And he's just printing and filming and just, you know, creating posts. And he's done brand stuff with Apple as well. Like, so he's hitting, like, within the space of 5 years. I mean, it's insane the speed that it can move at, isn't it?
It is unbelievable. It goes quick.
Yeah. And compared, I guess, to kind of when you started, because one of the things I love about doing this show is like talking to people who are like actual working photographers, which I think is something you touch on a lot in your videos, right? Like, there's lots of YouTube photographers, in air quotes. And then there's people who've done it for reals and for a living.
And apparently I make angry people episodes.
I think, unfortunately, that's posting things on the internet, I think, to some extent.
That's true.
At least you know people are watching. They've got true. Strong opinions about your camera for reasons.
Yes. Yep, they do.
So because I'm curious about this, I guess, because when you were starting out, like in film, and, you know, like you've talked about recently in a video, you know, like manual focus and, you know, in some cases using lenses that like haven't changed a great deal in the kind of following 40 years, like what for you's changed? Because it feels like the hustle and the work is actually still potentially still the same in a lot of ways.
I, Actually, I think it's harder now with digital than it was with film, because I really was a working photographer all my life, and when I worked for major studios, you shot the pictures and then you handed over the film and it got sent out, and all the work was done by someone else after that, which was now it's you do the shoot and then you spend 4 hours later editing photos. And we didn't have to do that back in the day. It was, we just shot. That's what we did. And we had to get it right in camera. There was no, the retouching was done by two old women in a, with paintbrushes. I mean, so today, I think it's harder today to be a working professional, because you're doing twice the work, three times the work than you did back in the day.
It's interesting. I used to know, I don't think he shoots MotoGP anymore, but a guy used to shoot MotoGP, and he said the same thing. When he'd started out, it was film, and it was great. They could, the race finished, and as he put it, it was like the race finished, you went to the pub. You'd
Yeah,
handed your bag
exactly.
of film to someone, it was someone else's problem. And now he's got to get it all ready. He's got 20 minutes after the race. They want the sponsors' logos on display. They want it. And so he, for the longest time, he had me shooting just JPEGs in camera because his thing was speed. And
Yeah.
you know, because I went in, I went into that assuming you'd shoot raw and assuming you'd tweak and whatever. And it's like, no, it's
Right.
not art. It's this is my job. Like I've got to get
Yeah,
it done.
yep, exactly. You know, it's funny. Like, I remember my transition into digital, and my very first digital camera was a Fuji camera. It was an oval shaped camera, and it was a prototype. And a friend that worked at Fuji sent it to me to say, "Hey, look at this thing." I'll never forget that. But I was so intrigued, and it was Photoshop one at a time. And I said, "I have to get a digital camera." And that's when the like soon after the Kodak DCS 620s came out. And I got one of the 620s, and I was working for a newspaper at the time, which was, horrific work. You can't believe I did it, but you didn't have the luxury of sending the film out. You had to go back to the newspaper, develop your own film, scan it in, do the whole nine yards. And I was a stringer. I wasn't actual for the newspaper. I just did work on the side for them. But you get $25 for every print that went, that got published. And the newspaper I worked at had a their solid newspaper, and then they had four other newspapers for four different towns in the area that were published once a week. So I got the Kodak DCS 620. It was 2.1 megapixels, and I was able to pump out so much work. I was making $1,500 to $2,000 a week in published stuff because I could just go with that digital camera. And I, the funny thing is like my one wall of my house is filled with images just from that 2.1 megapixel camera. And I'm looking at them going, the old Kodak CCD sensor. I absolutely loved it. But that camera was a joy. It was big and honky, but I didn't care. But that was my transition into digital, and I never looked back after that.
No, that's wild, isn't it, to think? Because I guess it would have given you such a speed advantage.
Oh, it
And
was unbelievable. I had some angry photographers at the newspaper because I was doubling their pay every week. I mean, it was really that insane.
I
So the
always
camera
imagine
paid
that.
for itself.
Yeah, I'll bet it did. I always imagine that selling newspaper photos is like, you know, in Spider-Man, like going up in front of J. Jonah Jameson, like, this is trash, I'll give you $5. Kind of like
Yeah.
it's because they've got a margin they're working to.
Yeah, I liked the $25 per image. I don't know if it's feasible today, but for me it was great because of the amount of newspapers that I was able to publish, and I was in every single newspaper every single week, at least three to four images, and summers just boomed. I mean, it was I made bank. And the camera back then, I think I paid $9,000 for it, a 2.1 megapixel, and I remember it was an 840 megabyte memory card that was like $890. Yeah, it was a treat starting out in digital, but
And
I've
no
been doing it
internal
since then.
storage. No internal
No,
storage in that thing.
but I'll tell you what, it had some unique features that I wish they would bring back. Like, if you accidentally deleted an image, you can retrieve it right from the camera and stuff. It was there was some, very cool features in there.
Oh, that's neat. Yeah, I it was funny. I watched your video earlier. I was just going through some other stuff, and your one about the M. I must have watched a version of that video from just about every. I think it's a rite of passage, and every YouTuber's photography YouTube person's sort of like YouTube journey. If they shoot a Leica, is like, ah, right now I have to explain to people why I do this. Okay, here we go. And when you were talking about the internal storage on the 11 and what a big difference that makes, I had that last week. I was on holiday and it was just me and my wife, but we took some photos. I got some photos of some of her friends who were on the trip as well, and I had that thing where at that moment where you pull the images you want off the memory card and then you just put the memory card in and you just format it because you're on automatic pilot, and then you remember that you meant to pull the ones from yesterday afternoon off as well, and you feel that drop in your stomach, and you just thank God for the internal storage on that thing as well,
I
because
agree.
otherwise, yeah, I never want to go back.
There was a, my story with Leica started in probably 1985. And there was a bar in our area, and it was a higher end bar. But this gentleman that was a Leica representative, he used to go there to drink, and he opened up his wooden case the one time at the bar. It was a big wooden case, and it had filters in it, it had lenses in it, it had bodies in it. But it was his presentation case. And like when he opened that case, I swear the angels sang. I was like, I couldn't afford it then, I couldn't afford it 10 years ago. But once I got one in my hand, and I mean, the biggest question I get is, can you manual, is it easier to manual focus? Do you think I'll be able to do it? I'm like, I'm 60. I have 20/40 vision in the eye I shoot with. And I don't have a problem with it. It's just a matter of getting used to it. And I think everybody goes into focusing like a, the instant thing to do is, I'll put it at 1.4 and shoot. And it's just not possible your first couple of weeks. So I told everybody, start at 5.6 and then slowly go down to that 1.4 after you get used to focusing with it. And it'll be a dream for you. Like in 2 weeks, you'll have it down solid. But don't start at 1.4, start close down a little bit and then work your way up to the 1.4.
Which I think is a nice kind of segue onto kind of your three lenses, because you and I share, well, a couple of things, I guess. One things I noticed watching your videos, like in the last sort of 6 to 8 months, is the fact that you like the Voigtlander 90 2.8 as much as I do. I think
Oh,
that's a trim so
I'll tell
good.
you what. Like I've taken that to concerts. I shoot a lot of entertainment, both in studio, for networks, and in front of stage. And when I'm in front of stage, I'll pick that 90 every day of the week because it is seriously one of the best lenses I've ever used. It's really that good. My problem, only problem with it, is I've had three copies already. And
Oh,
the
wow.
infinity focus, when I go to infinity, I need a hard stop for infinity focus. That 90 for me has not had it yet. So if I get stuck back by the board, I'm shooting it at infinity. I have to like go to the hard stop and then back off a little bit to get the focus point, which with live entertainment, you don't have that luxury. It's just not, you can't guess at it. You can't. So that's the only time I don't use that lens is, if they call me and say, you're back by the board, I'm done. I'm using the Elmerich, the 90 Elmerich. It's not as sharp. There's no if, ands, or buts, but I don't have a choice because I know the hard stop infinity is going to give me an in focus photo.
No, that's fair. I used the 90 when I was at the MotoGP last year in Assen in Holland. Friends of mine were like, you're insane doing this, but I had an M10 at the time, and I shot the MotoGP just for fun, just because I was there and I could, we had seats at the end of the start finish straight, so you're kind of cheating a little bit because you're getting them when they're slowing down. But you get a couple of pleasing shots and you get a little bit of the environment in there as well, and it was a great lens, and it was so much better than lugging around like a huge camera bag filled with 200 mil or whatever lenses, because it's not your job. You should just be there to enjoy it.
Oh, that's,
If you're
that's it.
taking it with you. But the other thing I think we have in common is you're recently a 35 shooter, and your first lens choice is
God, I
the
hate to
35
say
Apo. Why?
I don't know. Like, I've been a 50 shooter all my life. Like, I
Oh.
love 50, and I use 50 for, I mean, I have shot some big people on my 50 that, and I like just recently really started playing with a 35 more, and I'm just falling in love with this lens. I'm falling in love with the focal length. I didn't think I would ever say that.
Well,
I
it's
really
funny
didn't.
because Vieran Pavic, who was on a couple of episodes ago now, but like as this goes out, it'll be a little bit further back. He's one of the producers at The Verge, and he was talking the other day about because he's doing a lot of video production as well as stills photography. But the point he made that people keep messaging me about since his episode went out is that you can crop in, but you can't crop out. So if you shoot 35, especially on a modern high-res sensor, if you do want to, you've got that latitude. I
I
agree. I'm
agree.
with you. Like, I like to get it in camera as much as possible, mostly out of laziness, really, as much as anything else. But I think there is that option there. And 35 is, it's not 28. It's not insanely wide. You're not throwing away tons of detail or lots of the image or having to compromise as much. But you are, but you've still got a little bit of flexibility. But yeah, I've been a 35 person for like, I mean, probably ever. So I'm pleased that you're a convert, like come and join us.
I'm really well. Here's the thing. Like, I just posted a video today on the 35 Nikon 1.2, the version 3, and I definitely didn't think I was going to like this lens as much as I do, and I just fell in love with the rendering. I sound like a Voigtlander fanboy, but you can't help it once you put those apos in your hand, whether it's the 35, the 50, or the 90, and then you have something like this 35 1.2. That is so lightweight and small for a 1.2. It's just mind-boggling. And the rendering, I just fell in love with in the back of the camera. Like, I took one shot and I was like, I can't believe I like this as much as I do. It was an instant purchase. It was done. It was, I can't say no to this.
No, they make fantastic lenses. My go-to 35 is the Zeiss 2.8, because when I was growing up, my first camera was a Canon point and shoot that was 35 2.8. And I think that's what a photo looks like in my mind now. And so when I use other focal lengths, I'm aware of it and I'm using it for specific things, but the default in my head. And also it's really small. The Zeiss compact 35 2.8.
What surprises me is I grew up with a Zeiss glass on my enlargers, and I would not use anything else but Zeiss glass on my enlargers. I love them that much, and I've never used a Zeiss lens on a camera.
Wow.
Other, well, I have. I have to say, because I believe I use them on the Hasselblad, but I've never picked up a Zeiss for the M, which is surprising to me.
Well, that
And
35 Biagon's really good. It's
okay.
I prefer it to the 2. I had the F2 35 and it's really, really good, but the kind of the rendering was just not what I wanted. Like I the thing I love about the Biagon, the 35-28 is that it's just a bit textured. Like it's not sharp edge to edge, but it's really, really Zeissy, contrasty, sharp in the middle. It's
Okay.
amazing for black and white as well. It's the black and white images. I'll send you some of the ones, after this that I think they sing. And I think the when it's the background, the bokeh in the background, it just has this kind of antique kind of feel, but not too much, So yeah, it's really
It's
fun.
that lens you get in your hand and you just know it's magic. You don't care about anything else. Like, every
No.
time this 35 knocked it, like, I didn't look for chromatic aberrations. I didn't look for the corner. I didn't care. Because the rendering was so nice, why would I give a crap about anything else if it's that nice? Like,
Exactly.
I'm not going to shoot a chart or a wall to say, oh, well, I really can't. It just doesn't matter to me. I
No.
mean, the surprising point is that I tried the 50 F1 on the M and I didn't like it. Don't get me wrong, it's a spectacular lens, but I just didn't like it. I don't know why, it just wasn't for me. Then I put that 50 F1 the Z mount on that Nikon camera, and I was just blown away by the quality of it, and I loved it. So you really have to put a lens in your hand. You can't go by reviews. It's just, and I'm sorry to say that, but it's true. You just don't know until you use it yourself.
No, exactly. That was, I think that's the big reason why I have these conversations, is to kind of like this thing is, it's a broad church, right? And it should welcome everyone. And it doesn't matter whether you use Zeiss glass on an M body or like Nikon's only, you know, because you love the Nikon stuff or whatever. Are you still shooting much with your the ZF? Because you picked up one of those fairly recently, didn't you? Or you were trying one out.
I do play with it quite a bit. I do shoot some jobs with it. I still, when you shoot the Leica M, especially the M11, and go to any other camera, color shifts really bother me in the Nikons. And I was a Nikon shooter, all my life. I remember the first time I shot Nikon was, I shot the F3 HP, and I used that for the Tonight Show in California, when Johnny Carson was still there. And I love the system. But now that it's digital, I started digital with the seven, I think it was a 7.2. And the colors were fine, but once I went to Leica and that color science, and Hasselblad's ridiculous with color science as well. It's hard to go back. It's hard to like justify, well, I really have to work on this in post-production to get the color right. If I'm doing outdoor work with no flash, I don't have an issue with Nikon. But the second I introduce flash with Nikon, there's some color shifts that I just don't like, and have a really hard time correcting. With Leica, I'm not correcting. I'm getting out of camera. I shoot a gray card for my white balance. I always shoot gray card, whether I'm indoors, outdoors, whatever. And but if I'm shooting, flash, I'll shoot the gray card, not setting the white balance, just shooting the gray card so I can use it in post. But Leica has the gray card shot where if you're shooting ambient, you shoot a gray card and it sets the white balance for you to the gray card, and it's always spot on perfect for me.
I think it does come down to that kind of, and again, it's a lot of people who leave comments who maybe are never even gonna, like, they're not actually that interested. They just want to shout at you for spending as much money as you did on a camera. But when it's your workhorse, when it's like, that's the thing that I think, that's why it's so nice to talk to people again who do it for a living. When it's the thing that's your job, if that saves you time and gives you consistency, then it's worth that amount of money. You'll make that back on a couple of jobs, you know?
Oh
It's
God, yeah. Well, that's the thing, though. You can't, the whole argument with price is just blown out of the window. I mean, you have the Sony cameras that are $6,000. You have the Nikon camera, five, 6,000. I mean, come on, you throw a couple lenses on that are 10 times the size of a camera body for Leica. I was shooting Canon, the R5, and I absolutely love the color science. I love the camera system. But then I was at an event where I'm carrying three lenses and aching at the end of the day. I was like, no way.
No, I mean, that's the other thing I like about the 11. I've got the black one, so it also weighs less,
Right.
which is a big deal.
I still want to try a 10. It's in my head to try it. I really do want to try a 10.
It's funny, it's nice. I mean, I really loved like the base plate. It was my first experience of an M, was a 10, and it was and so it does have that talismanic quality and the base plate coming off and feeling like a film camera and all of those things. It's a wonderful tool to use, and the heft and the brassing, I do miss that. But these are silly sort of, the problem is you're trading that for just the insane versatility combined with like 70 years plus of lenses that just go on the front and just work. And like you've said before, you buy that lens, it's expensive, but then that's you. They're not going to do anything probably to mess with their lens lineup at this point. So that Sumilux will clearly, if it's good at 60 megapixel, when they inevitably go to 100 or 120 or whatever, wherever it ends, if it ends, they'll that glass will still be good. No more lenses. I love that. I love not having to worry, and that's why manual focus is so nice. They're not going to introduce a different autofocus system that requires me to buy all the lenses again.
Exactly.
Yeah,
Well,
that's great.
I gotta say, the Voigtlander lenses, the new lenses, like the Apos and this Nocton, I mean, they do seem to resolve better on the 60 megapixel than a Leica lens is. And I know I'll be trashed for that, but
no, I think that's the point of having an interchangeable lens system camera, is that you can interchange the lenses, not that you can only buy them from one company in Wetzlar.
Yeah. I mean, I believe me, I still use Leica glass, but you know, for every commercial job I have, I'm picking up the 50 or 35 Apo because you know, the client can tell a difference, you know, and when they edit the images, because they do all that work for me, they're just like, we need this lens, we need this, you know, quality every time. So, you know, they're my workhorses. And that's, you know, that's the thing with me with the, like, people were like, you can't use this professionally. I'm like, why can't you? I mean, the only reason I didn't go to Leica previously is because of the internal storage, you know, because I can't do a job and say my card's bad. And it's happened to me several times, so I don't want to deal with that.
No.
You know, so, and jobs now are actually fun for me again. They're like, it's like my hobby again, because I'm enjoying the system so much.
Well, that's wonderful. What is it, do you think, about the, like, the 35 and the 50 that you've got? Because those Apos, they made a big splash when they came out with the 50 Apo especially. Like, there was the flurry of, you know, everybody was like, is this better than Leica's lens? And I think the general consensus was it's, you know, it's possibly a higher quality lens than the Summicron. Is it F2 that it goes down to? So it's kind of compared to the
Summicron. Yeah, it's F2. I mean, you know, Leica's Summicron Apo, I'm sure, is good. I picked a used one up, sent it back the same day because I didn't like it. It could have been bad. I don't know. But I've never had a bad Apo from Voigtlander. And the quality, and when a client calls you and says, you know, we have to use this lens all the time, because I used an Apo one time for them and it was done. They said, you know, we don't know what camera you used or, you know, how this was done. They weren't talking about the lens in particular, but they said these files are what we need all the time. And it really is, there's a difference. There's just, it's not a question ever with me. At F2 or 5.6, it just doesn't matter. I'm getting the images they need or they require. And that's, you know, that's all you have to say about the lenses. I mean, they're that good.
What does your split look like for kind of in studio as well? Because you do so much. I know nothing about in studio photography or flashes or whatever. Like, I've written down a couple of times, like, that Fuji flash that you use.
The EFX 20.
Yeah, because that, again, for me, it's all like size overcomes everything, right? Like, for me, if it's small, I'll take it places and that will mean it'll get used. But what's the split like for you? Because in studio, obviously, you've done a lot of studio work, lots of model and light setups, and you've done some really good videos about that, of like sort of showing people how you kind of set things up and how you do that. But is there you've presumably shot loads of available light and sports events and weddings and stuff like that. But are you more of a studio photographer now, or are you a kind of mix?
No, the problem is most of the events I shoot, I cannot publish because I do very high-end events, red carpet events, that kind of stuff. And I can't make them public.
Yeah.
So unfortunately, you know, I know people love when I do an event, and I did one, you know, and it got, you know, rave comments and engagement, but I just can't do them all the time because of my clients. You know, they don't want to be on YouTube like that. You know, but I would say it's 60-40, 60 being studio, you know, because I do a lot of commercial work, just, you know, the just mind-numbing clothing shoots and so forth for, you know, spring line, summer line, fall line, you know. And that's, you know, that's my bread and butter. But, you know, I do what I have to do to, you know, pay the bills and keep the lights on. So,
yeah, no, sure. I mean, it's a gig at a certain point. It's, which is why I think it's so nice to hear that you're enjoying, you know, being out and shooting again with the thing. Because at least then, if it is a bit kind of, right, I've just got to do 200 of these, or I've got, you know, set up a white background, photograph all of the exec team, and then photograph a group shot, and then go home. It's like, how many times have you probably done that in 40 years? Quite a few. But at least if you're enjoying using the gear, then that's probably
Oh, it's so much better. I mean, believe me, I've had issues with the M11 that would make most people's toes curl. But Leica has been there throughout. I remember my second M11 because the first one bricked. I had a job in New York to shoot some executives for a major network, and the camera bricked while I was testing it prior to going. And I had to call Leica in New Jersey and said, "Yeah, I have to come pick up the camera because this one bricked. I think it was the shutter on that one that went." And they said, "Just come pick one up." And they just gave me one to use for that day because of who I was shooting. But I will never forget it because there was some, major personalities in front of me, and I didn't care. I was too concerned about using the camera and enjoying the experience of the Leica M11 than who was in front of me. I just didn't care. The
Sorry,
setup, like you said, it's just one bag. Before you'd carry a bag that was, two times the size of you and the whatever else you needed for the lenses and everything. And now I take the body and two lenses, and then nothing else. It's like I had a Q2 as my backup. That was it.
well, that's a nice backup, though, to have.
Oh,
They're
I
pretty good.
absolutely love that thing. I absolutely love the Q2. I don't think I can go to the Q3, honestly, just because I love the form factor and the feel of the Q2 so much. And I just don't need a 60 megapixel on a Q3 body.
You don't
Or
fancy
I,
a flippy screen?
no, I really don't. I don't even like the word.
Do you know it's funny? I watched when that thing came out, they got Greg Williams, who does loads, he does all that candid celebrity stuff
Yes.
with a Q. He's used a Q for years. I love his work. It's really fun. He
Stunning
is at
work.
play. But he that one he got of Joaquin Phoenix after he won the Oscar, where he's just
Right.
eating a burger. I love that photo so much. And the one of Olivia Colman with tiaras on is brilliant stuff. But he said in the video that they put out that he'd had it for 5 minutes and he was like, I'm never going to need this flippy screen. What's the flippy screen for? And he said within 10 minutes he was in the back of a car and he was just holding it up and he's oh. And he suddenly found uses for it. Like I don't nobody needs this, right? I think it's just like nobody needs a Sony A7, what, 5 that shoots 120 frames a second and is basically doing like nobody needs that. But actually, there might be creative uses for it and things that you can do with it. But I do think we're clutching at straws now to sell more kit. Like we've surpassed what anyone actually needs at this point.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. They have to keep, and we have to support them because, if they're not making new cameras and people aren't buying them, they're not going to be in business. So, like, then what do you do? So you have to go, okay, bye, bye, bye.
Exactly.
I know I beat up on a lot of YouTubers all the time, but they're doing a job and they're keeping the companies in business. So, there's a double-edged sword there.
Well,
Without
on
them
that
being in
topic,
business, we don't have cameras.
no, exactly. But on that topic of the YouTubers, actually, what made you kind of start doing the YouTube stuff? Because you've been a working photographer for so long, and you've shot some incredible people. Like looking at your portfolio on your website is just it's awesome. Like it's one of the gifts of doing this as a kind of as a pastime is that I show my wife like the websites of the people I talk to, and then she's like, "Holy shit, that's Elton John and Steve Martin." I'm like, "Yeah, I know. It's really cool." So when you're doing the gig and you're doing this, and as you say, like people aren't always extremely friendly in the comments. So what kind of made you start looking at YouTube and start publishing stuff there?
It's a funny story, and I'm going to try to be as vague as possible, but there was a photographer that was somewhat local to me, and this person started doing seminars on how to do photography and charging an arm and a leg for them. And this person could shoot in daylight at the time and nothing else. And she came up to borrow lights from me. And I didn't know what they were for at the time. And I said, "You can take whatever you need." Anyway, they took the lights and they did a seminar for photographers and charged for it. And I was thinking, you don't even have lights. You borrowed mine and you were giving a seminar on lighting." And I was like, "This can't happen. You've been in the business for 2 weeks and now you're giving seminars." And my daughter was looking at me going, "What the hell is wrong with you? Put your knowledge out there. You're going to be dead soon."
It's kind of a sort of put it so clearly.
I'm going to be 60 in July, so I do have a lot of knowledge racked up, and I know, as far as YouTube's concerned, watchers flock to their age group, and I noticed that quite a bit. And if I was 20, I'd have 10,000 20-year-olds. I'm 60, I have older people, but there you get a choice few young ones that come on, and they'll start messaging you and asking for advice and help, and they're the ones that get it because I've been through it all. I promise you, I'm not the best shooter out there, never will be, but I promise you that I can shoot in any situation and get the job done, no matter what the scenario is, and get quality images because I have that background, the knowledge, and the experience to deal with anything that's thrown at me. That, again, it doesn't make me the best out there. It just makes me knowledgeable, and I have the expertise because of how many years I've been doing this.
Are you
So,
optimistic about the future of sort of the younger, like the people you talk to, and the future of photography in general?
absolutely. Oh my God, please. Photography is going to be right. I hear the, oh my God, some of the comments, photography is dead, and this and that. And it's never going to be dead. No one's ever going to want an AI photograph of their wedding. They're going to want their wedding. They're going to want their event. They're going to want their own headshot. You can't make that go away. So, is it viable option for product? Absolutely. But AI is not going to still take over product photography. You're still going to always have the people that just want great work. So yeah, I mean, as an addition to photography, I'm sure it's going to be absolutely huge. But I think photography is solid no matter what, because what we do is, that's why film had a comeback, and that's why vinyl had a comeback. It's, sometimes that old warmth is just what you need. So yeah, I have no problem with photography staying around for a long time to come. It's just not going anywhere.
Do you ever shoot film? I was going to ask you about that.
I don't. My daughter does, believe it or not. I bought her a film camera because I want her to have the experience. I told her before I bought it for her, I said, we used to go to the record store, wait in line for a record to come out, and you guys don't have that anymore. And sometimes when you go in the record store at midnight, and they open the doors at 3 a.m. for you to buy an album, the artist would be inside the record store as a surprise, and it would just blow you away. Even my little town here was just unbelievable. And I said it was the same thing with film. When I started out with film, you'd send your film away and wait for it, and it would be mailed back to you. And that just joy of opening it and seeing the prints, it was everything. And then I said, the developing, I absolutely loved the dark room. Until I did it professionally, but prior to that, I really loved it. It was something special. And I got her a film camera and she started shooting. And I got her an AE-1, I think it was,
Oh,
the first
nice.
professional SLR camera. And she just fell in love with it. And she does the same thing. She just shoots and sends it in and waits, and the anticipation is everything. It's special. It's way too expensive for me to do it even as a hobby. It's just too much money, and the prices are still rising. So, I'll tell you what, like the old time film shooters that are shooting digital now will say, "Why would you ever shoot film again?" And it's true. Like there's just no reason for it, other than the experience. And God bless you, it is a great experience. But to shoot a wedding with it, I know there's photographers that shoot weddings with both digital and film. For me, it just there's no use for it, and my clients don't want it. But for the ones that do it, their clients want it. So more power to them if they can charge the right pricing to get that done. But I started with film with a Hasselblad 500cm, and my first wedding, I was an assistant, and I had to wait a year to do this, because I was working for a bigger studio, and I went up to the balcony to shoot the overall shots with the 500cm, and I was told, no uncertain terms, you have to be very quiet, you have to pick when you're going to shoot. And I'm like, absolutely, I'm going to do a great job. And I ended up dropping the 500cm from the balcony of the church during the vows.
Oh no.
Oh yeah, that was my first wedding. I'll never forget it as long as I live. That
Oh no.
it's slow motion nightmares still today. It's
Yeah.
42 years later. But yeah, that was my
Oh.
first wedding. And we were shooting 12 exposure at that time, with the 120. And I'll tell you, but the camera still worked.
Did it?
Yeah, nothing
Wow.
happened to it. I mean, the back didn't break, the lens didn't break, nothing, because I had a bracket on there and I had the Lumadyne flash on it, and it hit perfectly on the Lumadyne bottom bracket. Shook up the camera, but it was fine.
Wow. That,
I still
yeah,
have that camera.
that's really cool. I feel like that needs to feature in a future video.
Oh God,
Like
it's
just
unbelievable. It's
yeah.
unbelievable.
Because
But
people would.
the company went out of business, the studio, because the gentleman died, and it was taken over but mismanaged. So they went out of business, and they were having a sale of everything that was in there, and I went back to buy that camera, and I bought that camera.
Oh, that's fantastic. Even if it's
Yeah.
just sitting on a shelf now, like just to
That's
have that
what
as
it's
a
doing. It
yeah.
winks at me.
A daily reminder that that's why you need two memory cards or some
Yeah,
internal storage.
exactly. That is so true.
Yeah.
That is so true.
Hugh Brownstone, who also has a YouTube channel, he and I have been talking and he's hopefully going to be able to find some time to do a future episode with us. He was saved by internal storage on his wedding day.
Oh, wow.
They were using, I think, a TL, like a TL. And
Yeah.
that had internal storage, which it turns out the internal storage on those cameras was a micro SD card.
It is. It
Yeah,
is.
you can take it apart and put in a bigger one.
Yes, you can.
Yeah, I saw a teardown recently where someone discovered that like years later. They were quite cool, those cameras.
absolutely hysterical. But yeah, Hugh and I talk on occasion. He texts me once in a while. He first reached out during the M11 debacle when it was first released, because he had
Yeah.
an issue with one of his cameras as
He
well.
did. Yeah, it wasn't smooth sailing for him either. Mine freezes occasionally and stuff. I mean, I bought mine used. Like I'm a big fan of used cameras, because especially at that price point. Thanks very
I'm
much.
glad you're sitting, because I'm on my seventh Leica body.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah,
Don't tell me
seventh.
stuff like that.
Yeah,
Having said
well,
that, I think
it
everyone
was
I
all
know has had that
beginning.
problem.
It was
Right.
all
Yeah.
beginning, and it was that freeze up, which just never went back. Even after you took out the battery, it didn't matter. I
Yeah.
had three of those. I had two shutters go, and then I forget what the other two were, but. The reason I got the silver is because I did pick up the M11P in black to start, and that camera did not work. Like, it worked for one job, which is funny. I actually literally went and did a job with it, because I was thinking there's just no way this one could be bad. I did the
Right.
job, it was fine, but then the very next day I had a job and all kinds of issues. Like the images were corrupted.
Right.
Everything. I was so angry. So I literally went to back to B&H, and they said, just take an SL and be done with it.
Yeah.
I took the SL2. I had that for a week, and I'm like, I'm coming back. I got to get the 11P again. So
Yeah.
the guy said, just take the silver, because you've always had the black. Take
Yes.
the silver. And I
We're
took the
now into
silver.
witchcraft, John. That's the
Yes.
only way. The only way to do this is with mysticism. We're just gonna have to
And
choose a different color.
honestly, I haven't had a problem with the M11P in the silver so far. I did do the upgrade recently, and I had my first luck up after the upgrade, but it
Me
wasn't,
too.
it was just that one time, and that was it. So.
Yeah, I did the software update the other day and a friend had told me it was fine and that I should do it. And then yes, mine froze like moments after I'd done the update. I think
Yeah,
sometimes
mine.
it's to do with how quickly I've turned it off and on. Like if I turn it on, take a few shots and then turn it off, like it seems to not like being turned off too quickly for one thing. That seems
The
to
only thing
corrupt
I
images.
different, I did, for some reason, I had the preview on, And I think I went to fire or shut it off prior to the preview shutting off, and that may have done it. But since then, I haven't had a problem with it. It's been flawless. So, you know, knock on wood, it's gonna work out just fine.
Yeah, I mean, I still love the thing. I'm addicted in a way that
I am too.
Yeah, I can't put that thing down. And my stepdad, like, he's a Sony guy, so he's got the A7CR. And he loves that thing, and it's tiny. And he's been grappling with whether or not he should like try a Leica, get a Q, do whatever. But he has trouble with his hands as well. And so basically, the grip on it is much, much better. All of Leica's cameras would require an extra grip, but then makes it heavier, and. And so it's just like you've got the right tool for you. He loves.
Oh my God! I think that's fantastic. That's a great camera.
Yes.
And I think they really worked out the color science on that too.
It's significantly better. I had the first A7 and I always felt, and I've nothing to back this up, there's no evidence or whatever. This is not a scoop to the world, but it just felt to me like the A7 came in hot. Like Sony saw an opportunity. They brought that thing out really quick. The JPEGs out of it were hideous, but the raw files were always really good and you could do a lot to them. And I had the Zeiss 35-28, unsurprisingly, for the front of that, which was amazing with that little tiny hood that they did. And it made the thing really compact. And I shot that for like a decade and loved it. Thought it was just the bee's knees. But everyone hated the colors out of the Sony cameras. I mean, you know, they're kind of garish a little bit. I think those earlier full frame, but the new one,
I pulled up my iPad just now. And I was looking at the search feature on the iPad in your photos, and I didn't know it had that. And you can actually pick people that you want to search for. So I searched for my daughter. And of course, I have like 3,000 photos of her on my iPad. And I was going through the photos and thinking, I can't believe how many Sony photos are on here. And a lot of them were the 6,000 with the 55 1.8.
Yeah.
And the A7 R2, I believe.
Hmm.
Which I was really surprised because I did own that camera for quite a while, but I didn't realize how many photos I took with the 6,000. You know, I took that to a lot of places, which really surprised me.
But it's very handy. It's a great size. I had a Nex 5N before they went to the 6,000 and 7,000 numbering. So like, I think the 5N was kind of the first one where the menus weren't hot garbage.
Right.
And that was a great camera. I loved that. Were you shooting the 55 FE then on the 6,000 body?
Or whatever their good 55 was.
Yeah. That 55 1.8 is absurdly sharp. Like if sharpness is what you're after.
That's my favorite Sony lens of all time.
Yeah.
Like I have a favorite lens from every system, and the Sony 55, I just thought was the size, the weight, the ergonomics of it. And the sharpness, it was insane. And I shot so many jobs with that because I loved it so much. And I had the 51.2 and I didn't use it as much as I used the 55.
Cracking lens. And presumably on the APS-C, that comes out to like, that's kind of 80. So it's good for portraits.
Yeah. And then stuff. For the Fuji system, my favorite lens of all time is the 50 F2, the RWR 50 F2. Absolutely amazing lens. That was beautiful. The sad part is the Canon, I love their 51.2, but like I said, the weight and size was just a turnoff for me. But that's a beautiful camera as well. And the color science on that is absolutely beautiful.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think that's the nice thing is these days it's hard to pick up a bad camera somehow.
It really is.
Everyone's making really good gear now. It's funny. I got recently the Polaroid i2 because doing this podcast is expensive. Because people mention cameras to you and then you have to go and get one. But even the lens on that, which is not a glass lens, they've done a plastic lens, but it's phenomenal. And it's so much better to work with because it's fully manual and it's sharper than anything Polaroid made in their heyday. You know, I have a 680 SLR and it's better, you know, it doesn't focus as close. But that's the only thing.
I got to tell you about a story about Polaroid. I started with this company. It was Ace Hoffman Studios in Pennsylvania. And they had Polaroids that they used for parties. And I just thought they were insane. But, you know, the owner said, "Dad, we're not going to do them anymore." So I said, "Can I borrow one of your Polaroid cameras?" It was at Christmas time. And he said, "Yeah, take whatever you need." So I took the Polaroid and I had free film because they weren't using them anymore. And I went to a Christmas party and crashed the Christmas party and just started taking pictures. And I used to charge $5 a picture.
There you go.
And I
Nice.
would make bank every single time. And the owner of the hotel, Mr. Giannetti, I'll never forget it. He approached me going, "What the hell are you doing?" And I said, "Well, I'm taking pictures." And he said, "You didn't even get permission." And I go, "I know, but people are liking it." So he would invite me for every Christmas party after that. I would do 10 Christmas parties a year. I would make so much money off these Christmas parties. It was ridiculous. And I had film at the Kazoo because it was a large studio and they had a large backup. And I would just keep shooting every year. I did that for 5 years. And that's what bought my F3 HP.
Oh, nice. Yeah,
Yeah.
the Polaroid, and especially in a party setting, instant film is still a magic trick. So
Oh,
I
yeah.
do a kind of very small scale version of what you were doing, where I've convinced work that they should let me bring my camera, and basically I bring the camera, and they let me expense some film. And it's really good time because you give people stuff, and then because the company is a mixture of remote and kind of in studio people, the Polaroids the next day start to appear on Slack and Teams or whatever it is, and people are sharing the photos from the night before, and they're sharing these things, and they don't share pictures off their phone in this in quite the same way. Like
Oh
they're
no. And
excited by the Polaroid.
the second you hold a print in your hand, I don't care if it's a Polaroid or a print, it's just magic. It brings photography to where it's supposed to be. I mean, you mentioned Greg Williams before and his magazine, Hollywood Authentic. I instantly subscribe to that because I just want to hold it in my hand. I love his work and it's so much more than seeing it on Instagram or on the internet. It's something physical in your hand that you can just appreciate the photos even more at that larger size in your hand. I think that's lost, and I hope that comes back as strong as film did because it's night and day. And I won't even print on a home printer. I send out to a lab because I want the silver halide prints. I want that feel. And I just think it's special.
No, you're absolutely right. Dan Milner, who was on recently, talks about a lot about print and printing images. And I remember I got a printer last year, like a Prograph, like a so I could actually do some higher quality, like what I would term, proper printing
Right.
at home, and like a decent size as well, because I was starting to make images that I liked enough that I was like, I want this in my house. And I also want to kind of string stuff up and have it around my office so that I'm living with it for a while, so that I'm looking at the image, so I'm not just like cycling through images on an iPad or a phone, and then kind of like archiving them and that's it, and never looking at them again. I want to kind of live with them. And I remember the first time I printed some images, and you go into this and you're like, I shoot with a Leica M now. I have some light, I've had some Leica lenses. I'm hot shit. And then you
Yep.
look at your images printed and you're like, oh no, all I can see is what I didn't get right. And
Right.
it's a really useful experience to have, I think,
Oh,
as a
absolutely.
photographer, to start printing and start to look at that
Sure.
stuff and, show it to people.
I have students. I do mentoring twice a year, and I take on five students twice a year. And the one gentleman from this last mentoring session, he had prints on his wall because we do Zooms, and he had prints on his wall behind him. And I was just like, "That's just, the prints were gorgeous." And what he came into the program for is not what he ended up going out of the program for because he is so ridiculously talented with scenic and not like trees and stuff, but everything. And I said, "You got to start printing. You got to start printing and framing and putting them on a website and start selling." And I'll never forget, it was like a week later, he said, I sold my first print. And it was, I said, "It's just magic. That's what it's all about." I said, "Someone's going to have that in their home for a long, long time. And you created it." And that's what he's doing now. And he'll make bank. I mean, he really will because he's really that talented. But until you put him in print form, you don't know what you. You know, people are like, "Oh, prints are dead." But you know what? People have houses, they have walls. It's always going to be that way. And they don't want blank walls. Nobody does. So if you offer it, they will buy it. but you just have to offer it, you know.
Yeah.
And once you do, it's a whole other financial stream. I don't care if you're a hobbyist or a professional, you got to make prints, because that's what it's going to bring it all together. And like you said, you know, I'll tell my students, shoot 36 shots like it's film. That's all you get. Go get them printed, 36 4x6s, like, and look at your photos in your hand. And it's going to tell you what you're doing wrong and what you're doing right.
I started investing in books not long ago as well. And I think that's the other thing that really helps, is to like look at other people's work and how they've described it, and you know, how they felt about it, and seeing images sequenced and
right.
telling a story with them as well. I think that's a whole other world. Like, I feel like it's only recently that I sort of feel like I can competently, hand me a camera and I'll competently expose an image for you, right? And it'll probably be half decent, but that's actually such a small part of what we're trying to do when we're making pictures.
You know, the funny thing is, I've been doing this for a long, long time, and throughout my career, it's been technical perfection because of who I was shooting for and how I was shooting. And now that I'm 60 and have an M and have like the Nocton 1.2, I want the imperfect photos. I'm pushing to become more like an amateur as far as that look. Because I'll tell you what, I appreciate amateur photos more than I appreciate professional photos today, because there's more feeling in them. There's more depth to them than what a professional would do. You know, the professionals are all looking for that perfect lens and that perfect everything. And it's boring to me. You know, you go on through Instagram and you can swipe for an hour and see all these technically perfect, boring photos. People don't care about that. They want emotion, they want texture, they want depth. That's what attracts you to a photograph, and we don't have that anymore. We have the same old over and over and over again.
It's one of the guys I've interviewed, Matthias Berling. I love his images for that. Like, you go to his Instagram feed or whatever, and he's so creative with his compositions that there's one stands out in my mind, which was his dog running towards him. And he like plays with lots of different cameras, and he's not a gearhead. He's like, it doesn't matter. I'll make great images with whatever you've got is the kind of the point of a lot of what he talks about on his channel. And some of his photos, I look at them, I'm just like, I wish I'd thought of that. You know, I've never thought of composing it in that way or putting it together in that way. So
I'm
cool.
Like, so in line with you on that. And it's so hard for me because 40 years of perfection and then going, I can't be perfect anymore. I want imperfect. I want feeling. Yeah. I want life. And it's so hard to go to that. And believe me, I'm struggling with it. I struggle with it every day. To just let go and go, you know, it's okay if it's not perfect.
Yeah.
So that's hard.
Do you shoot for yourself much? Because I mean, obviously you're working so much. Like, do you?
I'm trying to more. And I'm definitely doing jobs where I'll shoot the critical shots that I need, and then I go do what I want. And, you know, that's helping quite a bit. And I'm finding a little bit more that, you know, those shots that I'm just doing for what I want are getting picked up more. So, you know, it is starting to click, but I still have a long journey to go with that. You know, and it's kind of strange to say that, you know, I'm shooting for imperfection and it's hard. And it really is. It's just, my daughter looks at my photos, and when I shoot for imperfection, she goes, no, this is not perfect. Why would you put that out there? And even her, because you know, she's lived with it all her life for the perfect photo and perfect sharpness and everything. And she'll call me out on stuff, say, you know, this isn't perfect, because we're both in that same headspace.
Yeah. I was going to say, it's your own fault. You trained her.
It really is, honestly. You know, but she'll go out and shoot film and love it, or shoot on her Canon G7 or whatever the heck it is. And, you know, they're horrible photos, but she loves them. And that's all that matters. You know, because it's showing where she was and what she did. And you know, that's 50% of my photos on my iPad are shot with my iPhone that I would never give up in the world. So, you know, go figure.
No, it's a funny thing. I mean, as much as I joke, it's a joke with me and my friends when they're like, you know, you could take a photo, because I wear my camera all the time, like everywhere. Right. Like during the pandemic, I was wearing it just around the house. just walking around and just looking for light and things to photograph. And, you know, we all process that whole period in different ways, but that's just how I'm wired. And so when friends of mine are like, well, wouldn't you take it with your phone? I'm like, no, I'm not an animal. Like, what are you talking about? But but I have to admit, phones are great. And it was last week I was talking to someone at this company thing that I went to with my wife, and they were sort of saying, oh, well, don't you think phones will get there eventually? And I'm like, well, they might do, but I still want to use the separate thing. And they just, it was lovely. They had the pretense of being very polite and personable until I went, oh, yeah, I'd still want to. And they were like, really? they just couldn't, they couldn't comprehend carrying something other than their phone around with them for photos. You know, imagine that they had parity. Imagine these two things are practically in, the difference is imperceptible. You know, that computational photography and cleverness and whatever just means that two photos side by side, it's almost impossible to tell the difference. Right. I think I'd still like to hold the thing and use it, but that's impossible to explain to someone who doesn't have the sickness that we have, which is right. An obsession with handling these things and using them.
Well, it's my daughter came with me to a lot of the events that I shoot. And, you know, I have a picture of her sitting on someone's lap and getting her first sip of beer. So I'm not going to say who it is, but I was setting up in the next room. And this gentleman said, you know, I've shot him before, so I was used to him. And you only get three shots with him. That's it. He always said, you know, if you can't get me in three shots, you shouldn't be a photographer.
Right.
So I had to go sit up, and my daughter was three at the time. And he's like, I'll take care of her. Don't worry about it. I went in the other room, set up. I came back in, and here she is sitting on his lap getting her first sip of beer. And, you know, the first thing I do is grab my phone to take a photo, not my camera, because I didn't want to be obvious about taking a picture going, you know, if you ever piss me off, I'm going to sue you.
Yeah,
I did the same thing with Elton John. I mean, we were backstage, and I was shooting him for years. But he's the nicest gentleman in the world. Like, one of my favorite people to shoot, because he's just genuinely nice to everybody. It doesn't matter what you do. If you're pushing a broom or taking a photo or on stage with him, he treats you the same way. And, you know, my daughter was there. Or actually, it was a friend that was there, and it's like, can I get a picture? And I'm like, I picked up my phone and took the picture because I didn't want to be obnoxious taking a professional photo. You know, I just wanted the memory, nothing else. And so it didn't matter to me what it was. But, you know, I get carrying the camera. I mean, I have my, like, in my hand probably 22 hours a day. You know, it's just fun to hold.
No, they are. They're just fun to have and fiddle with. Before, during the pandemic, a lot of what I shot was on the GR3. And that was also great because it's so light and so small. And you could just put it everywhere. And it wasn't... The M's the same. People don't realize what it is most of the time.
No,
which
they
is
don't.
Kind of a superpower, actually. That's really good. Like, if they look at it and assume it's just an old film camera and what you're doing, that's brilliant.
Yep, exactly.
You can just get on with it and you can get a photo. And it's funny, I did something at work once. We had a bunch of placements for the year. And so we wanted a group photo of them all outside. So I was up a ladder, and the company has a 5D that we use for kind of company things. And I had my M, and it was funny. I did the first few shots with my M and then slung that over my shoulder and then picked up the 5. And they were like, and it had a big lens on it. And they were like, oh, look, here's the big gun. And I'm always reminded of that bit in Iron Man 2, where, like, he's explaining to Rhodey, he's like, you have a big gun, I'm the big gun. It's like, nobody, you don't understand. Like, just because you have a big gun, like, no, this is not the same thing. I promise. And the shots we used were the ones from the M, because they were just.
I just think the M during an event is the best camera in the world. I really do, because it is unassuming. People are more apt to just be themselves around you.
Yeah.
And that, you know, like you mentioned that EFX20, the Fuji. I use that probably 50% of the time. If it's a dark, dark room, you know, I won't be using that flash because I'm going to get red eye more than often than not.
Yeah.
But if it's a, you know, a mixed lighting kind of room, that's the only one I'll use. You know, because I love the look of it. You know, two AAA batteries will last a whole night for me with that thing. You know, because it never goes over 1/16th power or something like that. And it's fantastic. But if I have to, really get good shots and it's a dark room, I'm using the SF40 all the time because it's just brilliant flash.
Yeah, that's the next thing I need to understand. I think I need to start to learn to fill using something small to start with, because I've been learning to do it with the Polaroid because it has an integrated flash, and on like especially like last week I was in Crete, so you've got very very bright sun and people potentially sheltering in shade, and you're filling and balancing out the exposure in that way, and sort of like so, I've kind of got the bug for it now. And I could see, it's funny, I underexposed a couple and then like got them right on the second one. So I had this kind of very quick direct comparison in a physical thing. So it kind of goes in more somehow when you're actually handling stuff and you're handling film in a situation. So I feel like I need to learn shots like that.
I can honestly say, starting out with the M11 with the SF40, the TTL is pretty good. I mean, you can get away with it, but the key for, especially for with an event, is get your ambient light right in your camera without the flash and take it down a half step. Take it down a 0.7 or something like that. Throw your flash on, turn it down all the way, and then just go up a little bit at a time for manual. The nice part about using a flash in manual mode in an event is, like, once you have that set, which is really easy, it'll take you three or four shots to get just the right mix. But once you have it set, you know that you set it at 4 feet. So if that person's 6 feet, because you're shooting a little larger group, you open up the aperture a little bit. Or you close down the aperture if they're a little closer, and it's really that simple. The only time I adjust the flash itself is if I'm doing a large group and I need the depth of field, then I'll adjust the power on the flash. But otherwise, I do everything with aperture and nothing else.
Yeah, same. It's quicker always. Just yeah. And that's again, it's why physical controls, like physically moving, rather
Oh,
than having
it.
to dial on a menu or.
100%. I've had the CF, and I again, it's a great little camera, but moving a dial on the back of the camera to adjust my aperture is just obnoxious to me. I can't stand it. I just don't like it anymore.
Well, everything's in the right place. If I'm twisting, it sounds so stupid to make it redundant like this, but like I'm twisting the bit on the front that's related to the bit on the front, and then I'm
Right.
twisting the bit on the top that's related to it's next to the button that it
100% agree.
drives. So like recently, like I just stick the ISO on automatic, set the shutter speed to what I think I need to set it. It's like Joel Myowicz thing, isn't it? Of like, right, set about 500, that's going to be about right, and then I just do everything else with the aperture because.
Now, if I could just break you of that auto ISO.
Well, I here's the thing. I was missing shots of little people running around from light to dark, and I wanted to maintain a kind of consistent movement. But yeah, because I thought for a long time I thought I had to do it manually all the time, and I think it's freed me up a little bit to kind of just enjoy. Because I say it a lot on the podcast. It's not my job. I'm a tourist, so I have to kind of also balance like enjoyment and speed, but I'll happily listen to like make your pitch and I'll try stuff out because I want to. I said it to Danny in the first episode, like the M is making me better because I had to relearn and learn, and there's nowhere to hide when you're in charge of that many, of the basic settings, and that's all there is. There's
When
you've just got to learn how to do it.
I was very young, I think I was a 22-year-old, 23-year-old. I went to a it was probably 15, 20 photographers, and like a gentleman was talking, explaining, and he wasn't talking about Leica. I'm going to get that out of the way. He was talking about cameras in general and knowing your camera. And he instructed us at the beginning of the talk that when he points to us, we have to shout out aperture, shutter, and ISO, any one combination that we wanted. And then, like, literally seconds after we said it, he would hand us the camera, which was a Leica 4, I believe it was. And that camera would be set exactly to what we shouted out within seconds. And, that's the thing that, that's why I always have my camera in my hand, because I'm always building up my muscle memory to exactly where everything is and exactly how to get there from where I was before. And I just think it's so important, because Something as simple as auto ISO. I use it. Don't get me wrong. I'm not a snob in that way. I'll use automatic mode whenever I can. But when I'm shooting something special, like I want control of everything. I want to be able to control how much light's going. I don't want the camera to decide anything for me. So, and you can do so much more with manual everything. But you have to get used to it. And even in those situations where, kids are running around or something like that, you got to build up that muscle memory to go, I know what I need to be set at. And I know what I was at before, so I know how many turns I have to go to get to that setting. And it makes it more fun. And it really is a game. It's a blast. I mean, it's just enjoy the journey. I don't want to be perfect because once I am, what's the use of even shooting anymore? I want that journey. It's so much fun.
No, I agree. I think that's it's endlessly fascinating, this thing that we do and that you get to do for a living. I think it's tremendous. It's why I think there's been such a reaction to these conversations, is that, people who take photographs really love it. They're really passionate about what the images they make and why they do it, and learning and being better at it. And so having a bit of gear chat with a bit of heart thrown in, I think is a nice mix.
Yeah, I agree.
Oh, cool. Well, John, thank you so much. You've been very generous with your time. I know you've got like places to go and stuff to do. So I will let you return, but it was wonderful talking to you about your lenses. I really, really enjoyed that.
I appreciate your time.
Oh, thanks, man. All right. Have a
Thanks.
really good rest of the day.
Thank you, sir.
Take care. Bye.
Bye-bye.
You can rate and review this series on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and that'll help people to find the show. You can also sign up for a midweek newsletter that I've started doing. You can get that at ianfarrell.com/sign-up, and there is a link to it in the show notes as well. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you next time.